Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast, made on Varick Street at WNYC. Does it ever feel like you've been here before? How I'm beginning to be an optimist about this.
How I'm beginning to be an optimist about this. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Gotta be honest, when I first heard this song, Pompeii, by the British band Bastille, I was like, it's all right. But the more I heard it, the more I found myself tapping my foot and singing along, and now it turns out I really like this song. It also turns out that repetition isn't just a part of music, it's an important part of how we listen to music. Dr. Elizabeth Margulies is the director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas, and she's the author of a new book called On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. Elizabeth, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you so much.
So I'm sure everyone listening has had this experience of, you know, a song growing on you with repetition. Why does that happen?
If you think about it, it's kind of incredible because musical preference seems like something so subjective and so personal. So it's quite stunning that you can find this effect robustly across lots of different people for lots of different musics. So you can just present people a song the first time. It's not that exciting. Nothing. In fact, you might disdain the song a little bit. And as it continues being played in movie theater lobbies or you're over your speaker system at your gym, you find yourself having exactly the experience you described, where you can't resist moving along a little bit. It's really gripped you. It's absorbed you in a way. And part of that is because you really know exactly what's coming next. You're able to think and listen ahead to the music in a way you couldn't at first.
And the brain likes that, right? The brain likes knowing what's anticipating and then being rewarded when what it thinks is going to happen next does in fact happen next.
That's right. I mean, you can imagine a clear biological rationale for a preference like that. I mean, if you have encountered something before and you're encountering it again, it's obvious it didn't kill you the first time. So we can see why we might have evolved a tendency to be attracted to things we've experienced before.
Right. Now, the idea that, you know, we're at some point we're no longer listening to music, we're listening with it. What do you mean by that?
So, you know, if you think about maybe, think about, let's say I say mana mana, mm-hmm. right? It's really irresistible for you to continue with some do 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 do's, right?
Mana mana.
Do do do
do do.
Mana mana.
Do 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 do.
You can't stop it. This is really what I mean, is that it's not that the individual sounds are coming at you one by one. It's rather that you're really actively predicting what's going to come next. You know, another thought experiment that can be helpful is if you think about the Star Spangled Banner, mm-hmm. this is an example that comes from Mark DeBellis, who wrote a wonderful book called Conceptualizing Music. And he says, you know, if we want to figure out if the words O and the words U are sung on the same pitch, what do you do? So if you stop and think about that, really you have to sing through that first phrase.
Right.
You can't just kind of duck in and grab out the O and grab out the U. The way we represent music, we bind all the notes together such that when we're hearing one, we're really thinking about what's going to happen next.
Oh, say.
So this all sounds great, but we've all had the sort of reverse the reverse version of this, where there is too much repetition and where, you know, you begin to actively dislike a song that you used to like.
That's right. And, you know, it often turns out that in the end, once something's been repeated too much, you end up liking it even less than you liked it in the first place. So people generally explain that with a sort of competing different process where, you know, if we only were attracted to things we've seen before, we wouldn't be very good at adapting to new environments. We'd be pretty vulnerable to things if the environment changed. So there's also kind of a novelty-seeking impulse that comes in at a certain point. And basically, you can you know, that this general curve is going to hold true across lots and lots of different kinds of music, where you like it more and then ultimately you like it less. But depending on how complex the music is and how much you know about the style beforehand, you can, you know, enjoy it quicker and have it become more tired more quickly too. Or you can, you know, sit for a long time, for years maybe, in that middle high point where you're really enjoying hearing something again and
again.
Well,
it's interesting you put it that way, because, you know, I've had the experience with this Pharrell Williams hit, the song Happy, where I thought, you know, it's very simple, but it's a well-constructed piece of pop music. And now I've just heard it so much, and it is a very simple song. And, you know, I think I've hit that other point on the curve where I just don't need to hear it again. And yet...
It might seem crazy what I'm about to say.
Happy. Elizabeth Margulis, director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas, with us on Soundcheck. Her book is called On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. And since that is such a simple song, Elizabeth, it's easy to like the first time, and I have found easy to kind of fall out of like with it as well.
Right. Now, I mean, the interesting thing here is that you might find yourself a couple years down the road, you know, in your car or something, listening, and this song comes on, and you might not recognize it at first, right? And you might be like, oh, this is great. And then when you figure out what it is, be a little dismayed. And we actually have some interesting data that suggests that all the kind of emotional circuitry in your brain is more active when you're listening to familiar music, regardless of whether or not you actually like it. So this can be why sometimes... You know, a song comes on that you actively disdain, but you nevertheless find yourself tapping along, humming along. And there's something about it that's a little absorbing, nevertheless.
So it's not just the repetition of the song that's on the radio constantly, or it's, you know, coming through, as you said before, the speakers in the gym, which certainly is the case with Pharrell's piece Happy these days. But there's repetition within the song. And, you know, I mean, most songs are built in the ABA form. You know, you have chorus, verse, chorus. So how far can you stretch that definition of a song? How far can you go trying to get away from literal, obvious repetition and still have it, you know, kind of make this effect on people?
Yeah, lots of times repetition is trying to work subtly. It's trying not to let you know that it's a process underlying your musical experience. So often kind of the more successfully it's disguised, the better. Because people are often nervous or embarrassed about music's repetitiveness. This is something that scholars in the 19th century, for example, got together and they said, you know, part repetition, so this practice where you'd have the exposition in a sonata and then you'd repeat it afterwards. Mm-hmm. You know, they thought that was really embarrassing. So they said, look, you wouldn't take a novel and repeat the first chapter. You wouldn't, you know, when you're giving a speech, say what you just said in the last paragraph again. That would be childish, or it would be maybe insane. And they were trying to make music seem more legitimate and intellectual and stuff. They tried to kind of downplay its repetitiveness. And you know, I think we might be in a position now to say instead, you know, let's face the fact that music is really repetitive and understand what's going on there and try to look at the processes involved rather than shoving it under the rug and pretending it's not there.
And you actually did some research into that very idea, the idea of, you know, repetition within music, and using some 20th century classical music, which has gone out of its way to avoid anything resembling repetition, some of it at least.
Right. And I, you know, it, much of this music can be loved and appreciated by people who have the set of tools and perspectives to enjoy it in that way. But I wasn't looking at those listeners. I was looking at people without any special formal musical training or experience with this repertoire. And I just played them either excerpts from original pieces by Berio and Carter, 20th century art music composers. I could play them in their original version, or I could play them in sort of a Franken version where I had gone in and crudely digitally manipulated them so that I inserted repetition that hadn't been composed into the piece originally.
Let's do this. Let's first hear a little bit of Luciano Berio's Sequenza No. 1. The series of pieces called Sequenza are a series of very difficult virtuosic works for solo instruments. This is the original version of this music by Luciano Berio. All right, that's a little bit of the original piece, Sequenza No. 1, obviously for unaccompanied flute by the 20th century Italian composer Luciano Berio. And now, Elizabeth, we're going to hear a little bit of what you did with it, where you've just taken one of those little phrases and repeated it, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's hear a little bit of that. That is still Luciano Berio's Sequenza No. 1 for flute, sort of.
Elizabeth, I'm going to get in trouble, man.
Elizabeth Margulis with me on Soundcheck. Her new book is On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. You mentioned before, Elizabeth, that you know there are listeners who have cultivated a set of tools that enable them to enjoy music by Elliot Carter and Luciano Berio. But for the general public, that first version of the Sequenza would not have seemed very musical because there's no repetition for the brain to latch onto. Once you did this, as you put it, this crude kind of repetition, added this to it, what did you see in your study?
Well, in the study, we saw that people rated the repetitive versions not only as more enjoyable and also more interesting, but also as more likely to have been crafted by a human artist rather than randomly generated by a computer.
So you randomly generated it through the computer, but they thought that had a more human sound.
Yeah, it's pretty messed up. So, I think what's happened, I mean, you can really hear this when you're listening, even if you're somebody who loves Berio, I think, that on the first hearing, it can be challenging to connect the sounds to one another. Whereas once in the repetitive version, you sort of have this sense of this inevitable kind of intention-filled connection from one note to the next that can feel very musical.
You know, Elizabeth, the original Sequenza by Berio reminds me of Birdsong, almost. But the difference being that even in Birdsong, scientists who've studied birdsongs find elements of repetition, of periodicity, as they call it.
Yeah, I think that's really tantalizing. And, you know, one of the things at the outset of this project that I had to ask was, is music really just this repetitive in our culture at this time? Or is this, you know, a larger phenomenon? And basically, so I looked to the work of ethnomusicologists, including Bruno Nettle, who claim that, you know, not only is music a human cultural universal, that is, every known human culture makes music, but also every known human musical culture involves repetition as a key element. And whenever something is universal, it starts to, you know, it's not proof that it's innate or has some sort of biologically endowed status, but it starts to make us wonder whether there isn't something going on at that level.
Right. And one of the interesting examples of this is, you know, anthropologists have sort of argued over the years which came first, you know, music or language, speech or song. And, you know, there's you talk about this 1995 study by the psychologist Diana Deutsch, the speech to song illusion. How does that work?
Well, basically, we're just going to hear Diana Deutsch speaking, the person who discovered the illusion. And then we're going to hear a short part of that utterance repeated a number of times. And then the trick is to go back and listen to the original utterance one more time.
The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible. The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible.
So she's singing there, so strangely.
Yeah, it's stunning. This works for about 85% of people, and we don't know what defines the 15% of people who continue to hear her speaking in the next version. But yeah, this is startling because it seemed to me before I heard this illusion that, you know, speech was speech and song was song, period, you know? And here we see that this is just exactly the same acoustic stimulus, but what has changed is our orientation to it, the way we're listening to it. We've shifted from listening to it as speech to listening to it as music. That shift is in us, not in the sound itself.
And as so often happens, the science here is kind of following musicians who have sort of intuitively gotten to a similar place, because I'm thinking I'm thinking of, you know, the early tape pieces by Steve Reich.
Yes.
And I don't know if you're familiar with this piece, Elizabeth, this remarkable work by a New York guitarist and composer named Scott Johnson. It's called John Somebody, and it just begins with a tape loop of a woman talking. You know, remember that guy, John Somebody? And it repeats and repeats, and then when he comes along with his electric guitar, he's able to kind of pin down the notes that are implied, that our ears are telling us are suddenly appearing out of this snippet of speech. It's a really fascinating kind of example of what you've been talking about.
Well, yeah, I was going to say this is something that babies tune into as well, and that we can understand babies tune into. I mean, if you think about the way people talk to infants, sometimes a little ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But often speech is slowed down. It's made more repetitive and more lilting. It's sort of musicalized in a way. And the reason people do that is because babies respond. You can get them in this beautiful little alert state by doing that. So we're really seeing there a way that children and infants are tuning into these musical aspects of speech. So it's really quite a natural thing to do.
The book is called On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind, by Elizabeth Margulies, the director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas. Elizabeth, always a pleasure to have you with us on Soundcheck.
Thank you so much.
You know who's in New York? Remember that guy, John somebody?
If you love the Soundcheck podcast, consider showing your support with a one-time donation or become a monthly sustainer. Go to soundcheck.org and click on support. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.
Remember that guy, John somebody? He was sort of a...